It's on sale. First come, first serve.
First come, first serve.
And those commercial forces seem to know no bounds. In 2019, global art market sales topped 57 billion euros. There are a range of factors behind the continuous growth in investment: low interest rates, a real estate slump, and the risky nature of the stock market.
During the initial boom in the 1990s, it was primarily Japanese buyers snapping up everything at galleries and auctions. But they all sold after the real estate bubble burst back home. And after a brief lull, prices shot up again with the emergence of new buyer markets. After the fall of communism, you had a lot of very rich Russians in the Yeltsin era discovering the art market. The opening up of China also generated a lot of extremely well-funded collectors, and that new boom never really ended.
A boom that does not only attract legitimate collectors and investors. As elsewhere, where there's money to be made, there's criminal activity.
So here we have the...
The Belvedere was Austria's prestigious national gallery, where all society people wanted their portraits to be admired. This beautiful Baroque building in the heart of Vienna was a favorite meeting place for the rich and famous. But for the moment, at least, the painting remained in the room Ferdinand had left in memory of his wife. As the 1930s wore on, peace in Europe became increasingly fragile. The Nazis had come to power in Germany.
Deutschland ist wieder eins geworden. Adolf Hitler, unser geliebter Führer.
Hitler's territorial ambitions soon became clear. Ferdinand foresaw Germany's intention to invade Austria and used his wealth to support resistance fighters to protect its borders. But that proved futile. In 1938, Hitler ordered the annexation of Austria, and German troops marched into Vienna. Before the Nazis arrived in the Austrian capital, Ferdinand fled to his country mansion across the border in Czechoslovakia, leaving the precious portrait of his wife by Klimt behind, with the rest of his art collection on the walls of his Vienna house. As he left the house for the last time, he would have walked past the Academy of Fine Arts right across the street. The shadow of Hitler hung over this place.
And George?
Eight works out of their frames with a knife.
As an expert conservator, a critical part of Sandra Lawrence's job description is forensic analysis of damage to artworks.
What we have on the screen are two of the paintings that were in the group that were stolen. The one on the left is the young Fitzjames by Henri Fantin-Latour, and this is the still life by Georges Braque. The Fantin-Latour was actually cut out of its frame, so if the thieves had come along, here's the painting in the frame, they would have taken a knife and just sliced along what's called the sight edge. This would be, if you can just look in the corner here, what a painting would be like in the frame, ignoring the cut lines, of course. The painting would sit like this so that when the thieves came into the gallery, rather than trying to take the whole painting away in the frame, they simply cut around like this. Now, just to look at the back of this so that we can see what it looks like, you can see that the painting rests inside the frame on this little ledge. And that little ledge is called the rabbit or the rebate. They cut the painting off, rolled it up to take it away. And what was left behind was this stretcher with the residue of the painting on it.
But the thieves still got away with 18 other paintings. Even though they were insured, the collection has never been the same.
It's a loss on the broader scale of art history. The
These are objects that people from around the world come to study, scholars over generations.
In this 1972 Montreal police report obtained by W5, the estimated value of the heist was $5 million. Today, the estimated value could be $50 million.
This theft represented about a quarter of the loss of the museum, so these paintings were highly valued as part of the masterpieces of the collection.
It was a big deal because things like that didn't happen in Canada. You know, people didn't rob museums. They robbed banks. We were the bank robbery capital of Canada.
The museum closed its doors while police investigated. But the initial search led to no solid leads and no viable suspects, leaving investigators no closer to solving the mystery, at least not yet.
As far as Lupin is concerned, the Mona Lisa can only have been stolen by a highly skilled international team of art thieves. And that's what sets the inquiry in motion.
Right from the start, Lupin's inquiry ignores the possibility that the theft could have been committed by criminals purely in the pursuit of profit. And it's a thought that's being echoed in the press.
In the days following the theft of the Mona Lisa, there are no press conferences being given by the police. So what do the press do? Well, they speculate, and a lot of them are completely out there and wacky and entirely invented by these journalists.
Among the major speculation was the idea that maybe a millionaire, a mad collector, could have commissioned the theft.
It has to be the work of an American, so that he could keep it in his own little vault and privately go down with his cigar and his snifter of brandy and look at the Mona Lisa every day.
A madman in love with the painting, just to keep it at home and maybe destroy it.
To sell more papers, the press put their own sensational spin on the Mona Lisa story.
It became not just a painting that was stolen, but a person who was abducted, who was kidnapped, who was missing.
Amelie Ebbinghaus works for the world's largest private database of looted art and antiques. Her job is to track down and recover works that have been stolen.
I can't provide specific figures, but there must be 2,000 to 5,000 works on show here. And the chances of there being nothing here deserving a closer look are extremely slim.
Ebbinghaus is an art historian specializing in the origin of artworks and other cultural assets. A large number of stolen works do end up back on the art market.
At art fairs, we often encounter classic theft, where most exhibitors genuinely believe they have a legitimate work until we say, sorry, but this was stolen 10 or 15 years ago. And that happens with both old paintings and works from the 1960s or 80s.
Ebbinghaus and her colleagues at Art Loss Register scour all the major fairs for stolen merchandise and make regular catches. Any paintings, sculptures, and photos up for sale at such events first have to have their origin and history verified.
I've had cases of people screaming at me for half an hour because we found something. It can be awkward, but ultimately the fair organizers say they don't want anything that shouldn't be on sale here for legal or ethical reasons, and exhibitors have to comply.
Every year, Art Loss Register solves around 200 cases of stolen art.
Coming up, it's...
This theft has dented the museum's collection and its reputation.
Stéphane Aquin is the current director of the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts.
It's a tragic event in our history, and it's a loss for the community. This museum exists only as a custodian and of these works, and in order for them to be made to be shared with the public. So the community has been stolen and robbed. It's not victimless. Everyone has been robbed.
Canadian art crimes writer Catherine Schofield has researched what took place after the historic heist.
A couple days after the theft, the director of the museum received a phone call from one of the alleged thieves saying, if you go to a telephone booth on McGill campus, and so they did.
There, the director of the museum received another call with instructions. Go to the Redpath Museum. Look for a cigarette pack in front of the building. Inside that box, you'll find a pendant, a piece stolen in the heist.
I'm sure that in the immediate aftermath of the theft, when the pendant was recovered, people here must have lived on hope for a short period of time that, you know, something would happen, negotiations would result in the recovery of all these works.
And there was a hefty $50,000 reward.
Louis Lepine, the man investigating this kidnapping, may be a snob, but he's also a man of science. To catch his skilled and cultured thief, or thieves, he's going to use all the latest forensic techniques.
Lepine runs a test. He has some of his officers try to remove a mock-up of the Mona Lisa painting from the wall.
It took the policeman 5 minutes. Because although it's not physically attached to the wall, the Mona Lisa is hung there on four iron pegs that you have to twist and turn a certain way to get it off. Lepine then had one of the Louvre workers, who was familiar with the painting, take it off the wall, and he just lifted it and took it off. It took a matter of 5 seconds.
Lepine has a good idea that the thief was an employee or former employee of the Louvre.
It's the third potential break of Louis Lepine's investigation. Now all he has to do is fingerprint the 256 employees of the Louvre and check them for a match from the prints found on the frame. Everyone who had access to the picture and who is familiar with how the paintings are hung will be checked.
No one matched the fingerprints that were on the glass.
Art thieves often face a major problem. While their haul is extremely valuable, it is often unsellable. Seen as images of the empty walls were published. Frankfurt police launched a criminal investigation. Over in London, the disappearance of the two Turners left the British art world stunned. They'd been on loan from the city's Tate Gallery, one of the world's major collections of modern and British art. At the time, Sandy Nairn was the Tate's director of programs.
The 29th of July, 1994, that date is always in my mind, and it was Nicholas Sirota, the director of Tate, and he said, we have this terrible news from Frankfurt. And I realized I was only just awake. It was very early in the morning. It was very hard to take in what he was saying, but he explained that the news had come that these two paintings had been stolen from the Schön Kunsthalle.
3 years later, two members of the Yugoslav Mafia were convicted for the Schön break-in, each sentenced to several years in jail. The paintings themselves, however, remained at large. The works in question are beloved in Britain. Their English creator, Joseph Mallard William Turner, is considered his country's foremost painter of the Romantic era. His style of depicting the elements of fire, water, and light is still today considered revolutionary.
It is quite difficult to say how important J.M.W. Turner is to the idea of British painting. He is the kind of way of thinking of British painting becoming something. I mean, there were artists before Turner, but really he changes the whole of British art. And he, at the end of his life, he himself decided to make a collection of particular paintings to give to the nation.
Nairn and his colleagues from the Tate did all they could to track down the two works. He made repeated trips to Germany to talk to authorities, while also holding press conferences on the painting's possible whereabouts. 5 years after the theft, an attorney who had contacts within the Frankfurt criminal community reached out.
And he said, I have important information. I have information from people who know where the paintings are. So, of course, we were very suspicious. We said, you know, how do you have information? What is this information? We'd had many, many false leads. I mean, one of the things that emerged was a sense that criminality leads to more criminality.
The Tate Gallery resorted to negotiating with the criminals. It took until the year 2000 and 2.5 million euros for the deal to proceed. Nairn flew to Frankfurt and took art expert Roy Perry with him.
He had to know that it was the painting. I mean, what if it had been a copy? What if it had been a fake, had been brought back? And so it was crucial that I could say to Roy Perry, you must examine this first. And he had the right records, he had the right photographs, but he looked at it and we all waited. And then he said, it's like meeting an old friend. And he knew that was the Turner.
In total, the Tate spent around 4 million euros to recover the paintings. But the strategy of doing business with criminals would prove problematic.
When an art-snapping job like this works, where you don't actually get caught and collect a lot of money via middlemen, then of course that's an incentive for other thieves to do it too. It was a story in the media, not just in Germany, but worldwide, including when the pictures resurfaced. The Tate was pretty open about having paid money, although there was never any mention of a ransom. They just said it was for information leading to the recovery. So more a reward than a ransom. In terms of museum security, every successful case is a disaster.
For information leading to the arrest of the thieves and the recovery of painting, asking for $500,000. The museum's director demanded that one of the paintings be returned as proof and a sign of goodwill. He was later directed to Montreal's central train station.
The Academy had rejected him in 1907, the very year Klimt was painting the gold portrait of Adele. Hitler may have left Vienna as a failed artist, but in March 1938, he came back in very different circumstances, and Viennese Jews grew to fear the knock on the door.
Just came and took things, you know. They didn't ask you. They just rang the doorbell and I opened and there they were. They were not in uniform because it was Gestapo, you know, and they didn't wear uniforms. They immediately asked me for my jewelry, which I had just gotten for my uncle. For my wedding present. It was Adele's beautiful diamond necklace with the earrings to match, and that went to Mrs. Göring.
Hermann Göring was one of the main architects of the Third Reich until the family handed over property to the Nazis.
Simply known as the Lady in Gold.
The three Klimts stayed in the Belvedere until the end of the war. When the Allies took control of Vienna, they rounded up all the looted art. The Klimts in the Belvedere were reunited with the one Dr. Führer had sold to another gallery and the one he kept for himself. The Allies took all five to Munich to be cataloged.
So they widened the net. They thought, all right, let's start looking at people who are outside the Louvre, who perhaps worked there maybe months ago, maybe some of our subcontractors.
An Italian migrant worker. He's not well educated. He was poor, very poor. And he probably drinks too much.
What's most interesting for the investigation, though, is that he worked at the Louvre for Gobier, and crucially, he's already known to the police.
He has a criminal record. He was arrested twice, and he served 8 days in prison.
Perugia's record includes theft and assaulting a prostitute with a knife.
That darkness throughout. So it's two things, it's genius and it's tragedy. And Juan Vincent actually created it for his mother.
He created it for his mother early 1884, and Vincent's father passed away, and he was a minister in the Reformed Church.
And the church is itself the church in which Vincent's father, the pastor, used to preach. Is that
used right? to preach.
So it really
so it's one of the most personal paintings for the Van Gogh family.
Do you have to deal with, where do you begin to look when something well-known or even obscure goes missing?
This world is very small, the criminal underworld, and they talk like old ladies at a tea club. They gossip the whole day, so eventually you get a lead. Stolen art goes from hand to hand very quickly. It's used as a banknote in the criminal underworld. So they use it for trading arms, drugs.
What's the value in the underworld?
The standard is 10%. It means if you steal a painting worth 10 million, you can use it as a banknote in the underworld for a million. 10% of the value on the open market.
This use of paint on canvas as a black market currency puts the art itself at great risk.
You must understand, these criminals are not art experts. We are here in a room with perfect air conditioning, perfect conditions for these paintings. These guys have no idea. They store it somewhere in a humid place. And what you see is after a couple of years, some of these paintings fall apart. So you cannot wait 20 years because it gets worse and worse.
For the Tate Gallery, it was a total success because they got their paintings back.
London. The British precious items have yet to resurface, although Ebbinghaus is confident it will happen someday. Some objects hit the market incredibly quickly, which means being taken across a border or two via Germany or Switzerland and being immediately sold. Once were. Private investigator Joseph Resch had offered 5 million euros to buy back the stolen jewels. Before long, he received an anonymous phone call from someone claiming to have them.
The first meeting was in Hamburg. I won't say how. And the second one was here in Bad Schwartau, where I was approached in the car park.
So began the most difficult part, negotiating the handover. Evidently, Josef Resch was himself being watched by the criminals. The man told him to come to another location a few hours later in a remote wooded area.
Inside a W5 got a rare glimpse.
It's an absolutely lovely little thing. It's painted on copper. And copper is a very, very flat surface, so it allows finesse in detail. It's a lovely scene.
But the hope from that return was short-lived. The next attempt to recover the art didn't go so well.
So there was going to be an exchange of money for paintings, and it was done a little bit outside of Montreal jurisdiction, and the local police didn't know anything about it. They hadn't been informed, and they did drive-bys.
Accidentally, like not a part of the operation at all.
Exactly, and it allegedly spooked the thieves.
50 years after the heist, the Montreal police confirmed to W5 the case is closed. Well, Canada doesn't have a dedicated police force or unit to investigate this type of crime.
Sadly, this piece would prove too badly damaged to ever be displayed again. Upon investigation, the police soon concluded the thieves had sawed a rough hole through a bottom panel in the rear door of the gallery.
Of the escalation in Canadian art prices. He's very esteemed, and we're lucky to have as many as we do in the collection.
When you think today, a work by Brock, a painting by Brock alone, one painting can go for over $1 million US.
But there was a lot of speculation, and because so much of the whole thing is shrouded in mystery, it's very difficult to know.
5 years that they would come back in relatively good condition. I remember reading a report in a paper at the time that T.R. MacDonald, the director, then said that basically gone for 2 years, probably destroyed. Because again, if they were stolen, and then the thieves realized they couldn't get rid of them easily, typically they would destroy them. But somehow they were kept intact.
Because the works became officially the property of the insurance company, there had to be quite a bit of negotiation and strategy involved for the gallery to recover the ownership of the works. But through various strategies involving different kinds of payments, that was accomplished, so they were fairly quickly the property of the Art Gallery of Hamilton once again. Fairly quickly.
And then the thieves realized they couldn't get rid of them easily. Typically, they would destroy them, but somehow they were kept intact.
Because the works became officially the property of the insurance company, there had to be quite a bit of negotiation and strategy involved for the gallery to recover the ownership of the works. But through various strategies involving different kinds of payments, that was accomplished, so they were fairly quickly property of the Art Gallery of Hamilton once again.
What we've got here in front of the painting is what's known to most people as a black light, or I would call it an ultraviolet light. What it is a fluorescent light with special gases and a special coating in the tube, so that the light that is coming out of it is basically the ultraviolet section of the visible light spectrum, or just beyond the visible light spectrum in the ultraviolet area. In this case, it's a fluorescent tube. And what happens here is there's a certain energy that comes from the ultraviolet light that when it hits certain materials, it causes some electrons to bounce about in those materials. And when they go back to where they belong, they emit energy. And that energy is seen by us as fluorescence. So actually retained these stretchers with the residues of the paintings on them, so that when the paintings were recovered, it was possible to match them up again.
With the world's media hungry for anything on the case, lead detective Louis Lepine isn't even talking to them.
But he would come home with objects from the Louvre.
Among these objects are some Iberian statuettes which he claims to have sold to an individual of some note.
The offer of a reward from Parisian newspapers teases out a lot of information and leads, but one of them actually led to an arrest. And the person who was arrested on suspicion of having stolen the Mona Lisa was none other than Pablo Picasso.
In 1911, Pablo Picasso was well on his way to becoming a famous artist.
Pablo Picasso was the exact profile of what Lepine thought he was looking for. He was erudite, international, even better, he was a foreigner.
Finally, it looks like Lepine and the French police could have their man. 17 days after the Mona Lisa disappeared, Lepine's men searched Picasso's studio, hoping to find items stolen from the Louvre.
The police go to Picasso, who's sweating, who's terrified, who's afraid that he's going to be, you know, at best deported, at worst, you know, sent to Devil's Island.
Immediately, they find the statuettes.
So he's in possession of goods stolen from the Louvre. He has in the cabinet back home.
It turns out Picasso hadn't just kept the stolen statuettes to decorate his home.
Those Iberian statue heads were painted by Picasso into the very famous painting, Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, painted in 1907 and considered the very first work of modern art.
Unable to deny it, Picasso confesses to his part in the statuettes affair. But it's the Mona Lisa police are really after.
It's ironic that Picasso should have been implicated in this theft because one of his very famous quotes is, "Bad artists copy, good artists steal." So he fulfilled his own definition.
After a few days in custody, police are unable to build a case against him for the theft of the Mona Lisa.
100% discount.
Other countries around the world do, like
24 more. Plenty of work to do.
Is there specialized training for someone that comes into this role?
Every art crime team member, after they are selected, has to go through a basic training for art crime investigation that the art crime team, the senior people on the team, actually give to the newer members. We're constantly looking to learn from the public, to learn from the auction houses, the galleries, the collectors, our other partners, both in the United States and abroad.
In the 72 heist in Montreal, you know, it was like straight out of a movie scene, right? Someone rappelling down a skylight into a museum. Do we still see things like that?
You may not see it as much as it used to happen. I don't think you're seeing a whole lot of museum heists where someone is spending 30 minutes or an hour within the museum, but it can happen.
Where do these famous pieces go? I think that's the million-dollar question.
For major pieces of art, you're probably going to see that artwork go underground, go dormant for sometimes can be decades. And they may pop up in 30, 40, 50 years later.
So Agent Deaton, when it goes underground, what kind of networks are these pieces going through?
Oh, it can go through a variety of hands, you know, to move it from, let's say, the United States to Europe or Europe to the United States. And everybody kind of gets paid in between sometimes. It can involve, the theft of artwork can involve transnational organized crime, networks of people, the same type of networks of people that trade in human beings, guns, drugs.
Pictures come alive in a different way each time you look at them afresh. But if I've learned one lesson on this journey, it's that criminals don't see paintings like that. They see them as objects, objects of exchange, collateral in drug deals, tokens perhaps in deals to be made with the cops or the courts. But going back to Amsterdam, by 2005, Ockie, the thief, he's been convicted, but he's not saying anything. Where could the paintings be? Holland? Somewhere unexpected, like the Ukraine? The fact is, nobody knew. How were the pictures going to be recovered?
We never stopped looking for the paintings, and during the years, our intelligence service, sometimes they got some information about, where the paintings might be.
Did you ever, in a dark moment, think maybe the paintings have been destroyed?
Of course. On the other hand, we always kept hope. So that's why we always looked into every information we got about the whereabouts of these paintings.
In the
the absence of new information, the investigation here in Amsterdam stalled. But then, suddenly, there was a new lead, 1,000 miles away.
An earlier Van Gogh heist in Rome would eventually reveal for the first time concrete information about the Van Gogh paintings stolen in Amsterdam.
I think, you know, one of the questions is what happened to this work, all these works of art at the end of the war, because it had been, and what the role of museums was today in this whole process. Many museums in Western Europe, in America, places that weren't occupied, Australia and so on, did acquire unknowingly, usually unknowingly, looted works of art. But up until this whole subject came onto the international agenda, and until there was a conference in Washington organized by the State Department in 1998, museums were quite, and art dealers, were, you know, quite freely trading in what may have been a looted work of art.
Because you're Italian, and it's signed Leonard V. Leonard being French for Leonardo, and V, perhaps Da Vinci.
It's been over 2 years since the theft, and the world had given up on ever finding her. So naturally, the art dealer is interested.
And he starts to think, you know, the Mona Lisa's been missing since August of 1911. Here it is, almost December of 1913. Maybe it's genuine.
You can't say, can I see some ID? No way. I deliberately parked my car in a way that ensured they can see I'm on my own. I took my jacket off to show I didn't have a phone or a wire. You have to be completely open.
The meeting, which took place in 2020, focused on how the exchange would happen. Resch asked up front for proof that they actually had the jewels.
The conversation ended up lasting less than a half an hour, and then he showed it to me.
The man had a photo of one of the pieces with a current edition of a well-known magazine.
In front of the magazine, you could see his hand holding these jewels. It was one photo. He was showing that he had the jewels, and the date was from August 2020.
While few art thefts are as high profile as the Montreal heist of 72, they still occur in Canada. Just recently in Ottawa, an iconic portrait of Sir Winston Churchill was taken and replaced with a copy at the historic Chateau Laurier. Back in 2011 at this art dealer's gallery in Toronto, watch how the criminals brazenly smash the front window and remove paintings, including a group of seven masterpieces. And this Picasso, valued at over $100 million, was stolen from another gallery in Toronto. Christopher Marinello says art criminals are hard at work in Canada.
August 2020.
The private investigator was satisfied that the middleman did indeed have access to the Green Vault jewels. The man would return them and collect 5 million euros. Resch then had to wait to be contacted again by the criminals with details on the exchange. But events then took a different turn.
Painting can go for over $1 million US.
To be displayed and needed extensive conservation. Luckily, the gallery had the foresight to retain the pieces left in the gallery after the theft. This allowed conservators to join the pieces back together. It was a painstaking procedure requiring exceptional expertise.
In this view, it isn't a definitive tool, but the information that we get from using it can be very, very helpful in diagnosing the actual condition of the painting. The next thing would be to take something called facing tissue, which is very much in conservation terms, like a Band-Aid. These facing tissues are applied to the front of the painting with a kind of adhesive that holds it into place. The piece is then transferred, like so, onto another piece of fabric, and it's actually completely adhered or stuck down to that other piece of fabric. This piece of fabric here is called a lining. And then finally, the entire structure would be restretched over a new stretcher. This whole piece would then be brought over, placed onto the new stretcher, like so. So you have your original painting and you have the lining canvas. So if you look at the back, you will only see the lining canvas. So that, in a nutshell, is the process.
Investigation here in Amsterdam stalled, but then suddenly there was a new lead.
Of art. He was found in his studio in the asylum, having drunk kerosene from his lamp, having eaten his own paint, apparently in the first attempt at suicide. So why would he paint a gardener at this terrible time? I think he had in mind a story from the Bible, Christ appearing to Mary Magdalene as a gardener after his resurrection.
I also think that it's important to remember Van Gogh had been a deeply Christian man, had been a preacher in his youth, tended to think in biblical terms. Is he looking for some hope of finding Christ again, finding some kind of salvation for himself?
November 2020. A year on from the Dresden heist, Berlin police carried out one of the biggest series of coordinated raids in the country's history. The operation involved over 1,600 police officers searching 18 properties and arresting a number of suspects, members of a notorious crime family. But while the authorities celebrated the arrests, there was still no sign of the jewels themselves. The man who had been contacting Josef Resch went silent, and Resch decided to change his strategy and turn up the pressure.
At 3, car.
We can never say for sure, but we can say that this is a deeply poignant image, a deeply vulnerable painting.
Jerry arranges to meet with this mysterious Leonard. To authenticate the painting, he drafts in Giovanni Poggi, the director of Italy's version of the Louvre, the Uffizi Museum. If they can confirm that Leonard does indeed have the real Mona Lisa, Jerry agrees to pay a finder's fee of 500,000 lira, the equivalent of about £500,000 today. On the 17th of December 1913, the Italians rendezvous with the mysterious man called Leonard in a hotel in Florence.
They go to the hotel and they see someone who doesn't look the part. He looks like an unkempt, down on his luck, relatively young and relatively unintelligent Italian worker, which is what he is. But he pulls a case out from underneath his bed in the hotel.
Inside the chest is a collection of what Jerry describes as a bunch of wretched objects.
So he's got paintbrushes, he's got shoes, he's got a mandolin, and he takes all this out, throws it on the floor, and there is a false bottom, which he removes, and he brings out this object wrapped in red velvet, which he then unwraps. Poggi looks at it, Jerry looks at it, it's the Mona Lisa.
Or at least, it looks like it. To check, Poggi examines the back of the painting.
Why the back of the painting? Well, it's a piece of wood that's been in the Louvre, that's been in Versailles, and it's got markings on it. It's got Louvre numbers. It's got a couple of stickers. It's been places. This is the trail of where it's been. Poggi has seen photographs of it. He knows what the back of a painting like this would look like. He looks at it, and it's enough for him to think, this may be the real thing.
Even the man from the Uffizi Museum can't be 100% sure, though.
You can forge a painting like the Mona Lisa. You can make something look like it's 400 years old, but you're not going to be able to duplicate the cracks in the varnish of the paint.
These minute cracks in the varnished surface of any artwork are the equivalent of a painting's fingerprint. And the art expert knows they're only visible under a magnifying glass.
He tells Leonard, we have to go back to the Uffizi. I've got some photographs there, and I need to compare it more closely.
That he lets them take his only bargaining chip, the Mona Lisa. He lets them take it away. Shows the naivety, the fact that he is not in any way an international art thief.
The Italians tell the man, Leonard, that if the painting checks out, they'll send him his reward.
It did match all of their archival photographs, so they couldn't believe their luck. The Mona Lisa has been returned.
Instead of sending the reward to the waiting Leonard, the Italians send the police.
You would think that he might realize he's made a terrible mistake, and he might immediately check out of the hotel and vanish. But he doesn't.
A knock on the door comes of his hotel, and he goes, aha, my reward is here. And he opens the door, and there are the Carabinieri. He's under arrest for the theft of the Mona Lisa.
It's been over 2 years, but finally the Mona Lisa has reappeared out of thin air. Now the focus turns on the man who was found with it.
This is like the unbelievable part of the story. Because he's Vincenzo Perugia. He was one of the workmen who helped put the Mona Lisa under glass, and the police had spoken to him. Not only that, the police detective had come to his room in Paris and talked to him with the Mona Lisa just merely feet away.
It's one of the biggest policing mistakes in the world.
Can you imagine the scene? You're in a very tiny room, plain table, one chair, one of the masterpieces of the world lies on the table, just hidden under a piece of red velvet.
What's even more remarkable is that French police didn't even bother to fingerprint Perugia, refusing to believe that this lowly Italian immigrant could be capable of such a crime.
So this is where the great faux pas of the French police, they could have cracked the case right then and there. They didn't think that Perugia was capable of committing a crime. They let it slide. It fell in the cracks.
The question the entire world is now asking, just how did this nobody pull off the crime that flummoxed even the greatest police detective of the age? And the answer defies belief. Just over 2 years after the Mona Lisa miraculously disappeared from the Louvre in Paris, lowly Italian painter and decorator Vincenzo Perugia is sensationally unmasked as a thief, and the masterpiece is returned. When the authorities discover how he did it, they're astonished.
At 7 a.m, Vincenzo Perugia enters the Louvre and climbs the grand staircase. He doesn't meet anyone on the way. And then he goes into the Salon Carré.
It would once again prove to be vulnerable. But of course, for the coffee, for the opera, for the great masterpieces in the museums and churches, and just for the ramshackle beauty of the old city. After the Van Goghs were pinched, a brutal war broke out in Naples between different factions of the Camorra for control of the drug trade. It was made here in the 1960s that led to the creation of these honeycomb-like buildings, created perfect conditions for those wasps, the Camorra.
The Shield King, one who had paid for the paintings, and his last will explicitly stated that all previous testaments concerning the Klimt paintings were to be null and void.
He just left a will leaving everything to my sister me and my brother. The last letter that exists from my uncle, written to the painter Kokoschka 2 days before he died, was, I am told that I might get maybe the portraits of my wife sent to me. So that was the last letter of my uncle.
And the judge said, well, yes, Maria Altman, you don't have to pay more than everything you own. You just have to pay everything you own. And literally all of her assets other than her home, she would have had to pay to start the litigation in Austria. And then Austria appealed and said the amount should be even higher than that. So at that point, let's forget about suing in Austria. Let's see if we can sue in the United States.
That was something Austria never thought possible. If Randy couldn't fight them in Vienna, he would fight them in his hometown, Los Angeles.
And how that happened was the pieces that had been returned, which would be this piece here, was sent to a conservator along with the piece that was left behind, which we will take.
Museum or now gallery is designed. There are architectural considerations and standards now in the museum and our gallery community for design, sight lines. There is the International Council on Museums, which we call ICOM, that back in the 80s started developing standards for museums and galleries.
Because after all, the foot is the same.
To flourish, that led to a horrendous drugs war in which many, many people lost their lives.
Not every day that I find myself in the back of a police car.
Cerrone, che è il suo principale.
He sees on the wall the Mona Lisa, which is hanging there. He pauses for a moment, looks around, listens. He doesn't see anyone, doesn't hear anyone coming. He grabs it, tucks it under his arm, and he walks out of the Salon Carré, where he knows there's a service staircase, and goes down several flights of stairs, then stops, turns the painting around, and begins to remove it from its frame. He takes it out, goes down several flights to a door that opens on a courtyard. He turns the doorknob, but the doorknob is locked. Not having a key, not knowing what to do, afraid to go back up through the museum, he decides, let me see if I can get this door open. He has a screwdriver with him, and he begins to undo the lock, taking off the doorknob, and then he begins to work on the lock itself. When suddenly he hears someone coming down the steps.
It's the plumber that Lapine interviewed just 2 days after the painting's disappearance, who'd admitted running into an unknown man by a locked exit door.
He goes up to the door and sees there's no doorknob, and he turns to Perugia and says, do you know where the doorknob is? And Perugia goes, no, I have no idea, I just got here myself. So Sauvé happens to have the keys, and he opens the door.
The plumber exits the door, locking it behind him.
Thank you.
night wind, cold and melancholy, wail a blue finale for my tragedy, like a miserere meant for only me, while I linger weary neath the willow tree. Right here our romance was started, here again we parted, when I set you free. All my thoughts are jumbled, everything is blurred, all the world has crumbled, shattered by a word. The end has come, my heart is numb, 'twas like a bolt from the blue above. I can't believe it, but you're gone, darling, and here lies love. The sky is dark, I hear a lark, he sounds as sad as a mournful dove. The dew appears like the tears of dawn, darling, for here lies love. All my dreams lost beyond recall, dreams of spring blasted into fall. Dry. There's only one thing I'm conscious of. I only know I can't go on, darling, and here lies love.
Listening to CKUW 95.9 FM.
On May 2nd, at Knox United Church, the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives Manitoba office will be hosting award-winning author and internet activist Cory Doctorow for a talk entitled Escaping the Anchitocene. The talk will focus on the rapid decline of the digital services we rely on, the corporate control of technology, and how we can seize the means of computation, build a new, better internet. Cory Doctorow, Escaping the Anchitocene, Thursday, May 2nd at 7 p.m., Knox United Church. Tickets are $25 and could be found on...